very clear, at least to those who know Hamas, that this is the way that Hamas will behave. This is something which is in the DNA of this organization. This organization does not intend to dismantle itself, and this organization does not intend to give up on his influence and position, not only in the Gaza Strip, but the entire Palestinian arena. And unfortunately, he will be backed by the Qatarians and by the Turks.
Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Mahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misgav Institute Senior Fellow and Senior Political Correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, Executive Director of the Misgav Institute, a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and your co-host. The Misgav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. Each week, we bring you fresh insights, not only into the most critical developments in the Israel and the Middle East, but also on the exciting trends and opportunities that are shaping this region.
Please subscribe and follow us wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read your comments and your questions, so please keep sending us them. This week's guest is Professor Kobi Michael, one of Israel's leading experts on the Palestinian arena. In fact, one of the people who founded the security cooperation between Israel and the Palestinians following the Oslo Accords. But before we get to Professor Kobi Michael, Lab, it's been an almost unbelievable week. So many developments, so many emotional highs. Where should we start?
Well, the hostages, the living hostages are all home, which is incredible. I mean, the atmosphere in Israel was like electric. Like you just, people were celebrating in the streets. I never saw the Knesset just like as full of joy as it was that day. It's Monday and it's a beautiful thing. Thank God, you know, it's a huge change.
I think we have to, you know, say the blessing, the Shekhiyanu blessing that we say when for arriving at this time. I mean, I personally did not believe that we'd say this, we'd see this day where Hamas released all 20 of the living hostages, and I think it's just been incredible. And the emotion, seeing the reunions between the family members has been unbelievable. So thank God that we reached this day. President Trump's speech in the Knesset was something else. You know, in some ways it was very entertaining, but in some ways it was also very revealing and deeply important regarding the present and the future of U.S.-Israel relations.
Yeah, it was the first speech from a U.S. president in the Knesset since 2008 when George W. Bush spoke. And it was just unprecedented in the level to which Trump expressed his love for Israel. That was, he said he loves Israel. But the level of commitment to Israel and like alignment with Israel back in the Obama days, Obama said that the relationship would benefit from daylight. This is a no daylight moment. This is this close. You know, Trump kept saying how much he loves Israel. He said, you know, I'm with you guys to the end. And he talked about how much he loves Netanyahu for sure. He talked about how Netanyahu would call again and again and ask for this weapon and that weapon. And he would always say yes. I mean, it's interesting because there had been all these reports, right, that like Trump was mad at Israel for the attack on Qatar and then pressured Israel to accept this deal to end the war. And I feel like this speech that he gave, you know, Trump like wears his heart on his sleeve, right? Like he's not someone who, if he's mad at Israel, he's going to just cover it up and give the most effusive, loving speech. That's the total opposite. We know that about him, right? And so this speech just showed that those reports are obviously not true. I mean, it just shows that the relationship between the U.S. and Israel is as strong as it has ever been. And it was really moving. I mean, of course, it had all these like hilarious moments because President Trump is just like that, right? He does the weave, as he calls it, where he goes off on all these tangents and he starts calling people out and telling, you know, Miriam Adelson is so rich and, you know, all kinds of things like that. Or I never expected my daughter to convert to Judaism. But like, when you really drill down on what he was saying there, I think it was a very big deal.
I agree. And it reflects an article that I wrote together with Meir Ben-Shabbat, Israel's former national security advisor and chair of the Miskatonic Institute. We wrote a piece in Foreign Affairs about Israel's new national security strategy. And one of the things that we argued was that it's ultimately Israel's strength, not its weakness or its willingness to make concessions, that is going to strengthen its international standing and its international alliances. And one phrase or one sentence really stood out from President Trump's speech when, quote, he was talking about the America is manufacturing all these incredible weapons. And then he turns to Bibi and he says, but you use them well. It also takes people that know how to use them, the American weapons, and you obviously use them very well. But so many that Israel became strong and powerful, which ultimately led to peace. That's what led to peace. And I think here he's right. I think that it was the Israeli operation in Gaza City. It was, I view, this is a little bit controversial, but Israel's willingness to carry out the strike in Doha, which communicates to the Hamas leadership in Doha that they're no longer immune. And it was Israel's consistent show of strength on the battlefield that also, I think in some ways, one, helped win the admiration and the continued respect from President Trump, from the U.S. administration, and enabled that close cooperation that led to the successful deal.
You know, there was a really good column by George Will in the Washington Post about this, and he said, you know, no, George Will does not like Trump, so he's hesitant to give Trump credit, but what he did give Trump, so the headline, right, is that the primary credit goes to the IDF and Netanyahu, but he has this line here: Israel has refused to trim its sails to accommodate gusts of critical opinions from people living comfortably at a safe distance from violence. And Israel did that, right? Even though many of our leaders, including Netanyahu himself over the years, have been tempted and have given into that temptation before. But Israel was able to do it in part because of this really, really close and strong support from President Trump.
And we'll see how that translates to, obviously, the next stages in Gaza, which we'll talk about in a minute, but also the greater regional context. Right after his speech at the Knesset, President Trump traveled to Egypt. And there he signed, together with the leaders of Egypt, Turkey, and Qatar, this sort of declaration. And this declaration, even though it doesn't have a lot of operative aspects to it, I think it's actually worth, it should get a little bit more attention than it did. There's some really interesting lines in it, very much in the spirit of the Abraham Accords. We understand that lasting peace will be one in which both Palestinians and Israelis can prosper with their fundamental human rights protected, their security guaranteed, their dignity upheld. They talk about cooperation and sustained dialogue, the historical and spiritual significance of the ties of both Christians, Muslims, and Jews to the Holy Land. And even in the end, there is a positive statement about the Abraham Accords. In this spirit, we welcome the progress achieved in establishing a comprehensive and durable peace in Gaza, as well as the friendly and mutually beneficial relationship between Israel and its regional neighbors. Now, what's interesting here is that the Emir of Qatar signed onto this as well. Qatar, as I think we've discussed here on the show, has been a negative actor in terms of Gaza and the war, supportive of Hamas, supportive of the Muslim Brotherhood ideology, using Al Jazeera to promote extremism and the Muslim Brotherhood ideology throughout the Middle East. And now they have their signing onto this declaration. So you kind of wonder, you could dismiss it and say, okay, it's just, you know, it's just a declaration. I think you could actually take it another direction and say, look, Qatar, you are declaring that you want cooperation and dialogue and sustained peace. You're obviously an important U.S. ally from the perspective of the current administration. You're in touch with Israelis all the time, right? You're talking to Israelis. You're bringing Israeli journalists to Doha to be interviewed. Well, then maybe it's time that Qatar ceases its incitement, ceases its promotion of Hamas propaganda, and joins the Abraham Accords. I don't know. Maybe I'm going too far. Maybe it's not realistic. I should mention that our very first guest, former National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, when we interviewed him, said that he believes that Qatar, under the right conditions, could potentially join the Abraham Accords. I don't know.
So, I mean, in Qatar and Israel had relations in the past. I don't know that it was full diplomatic relations, right? They didn't have embassies, but I think Israel had a trade office in Qatar. So I don't think it's like, you know, out of the realm, the realistic realm. And I appreciate your optimism. But I do think a lot has to change. And, you know, when Prime Minister Netanyahu had that call with Prime Minister where he expressed regret for the strike on Qatar killing a Qatari citizen as opposed to the leaders of Hamas, they talked about having some sort of trilateral committee together with the U.S. to talk about the issues that the countries have with each other. And Netanyahu mentioned I don't know that he said specifically Al Jazeera. I think he talked about incitement, but we all know what he's talking about. I often think Netanyahu and also politicians in general, when they want to, you know, kick the can down the road, they say they'll form a committee. But on the other hand, if you wanted to address this issue with Qatar, how else would you do it, really? So maybe this will be real. It would be nice if it was. You know, it's good to hope and it's good to try.
Another country that came up in the headlines on the same day was Indonesia. There were reports that the president of Indonesia would come to visit Israel. My understanding is that there was some discussion of that, but there was also a very strong domestic political backlash, which led him to back down from that idea. But you've actually done a lot of reporting on Indonesia.
Yeah, so I've been covering the current president of Indonesia's relationship with Israel for a few years now. When he was defense minister, he already favored closer ties with Israel. And there is business between Israelis and Indonesians, even though there's not diplomatic relations between the country, similar to what we have with the UAE. Indonesia is the world's most populous Muslim country. So when the president, his name is Prabowo Subianto. So when Subianto became president, Israel and Indonesia came very, very close to establishing full diplomatic relations. Our fellow, Misgav fellow, Ronen Levy, who was the executive director of the foreign ministry, was instrumental in that. He doesn't like to talk about it, but I've reported that already, so I can say that much. He was very instrumental in that, and they already had papers drawn up that they were going to sign probably in mid-October. And then October 7th happened and they backed away. But cooperation between Israel and Indonesia continued. Israel made huge, huge efforts to evacuate Indonesians who were in Gaza. It's people who were like volunteering in hospitals and things like that. There's an Indonesian hospital in Gaza, or at least there was. I'm not sure what the status is today. Because Israel wanted to keep up this good relationship, right? And then last month in the UN, Subianto gave a speech in which he basically said that if you want peace in the Middle East, like you have to deal with Israel, right? And you have to address its security needs as well. And when he, at the end of his speech, he said shalom. So that seemed like a really good sign, right? And then he and his office were really strongly considering continuing from Sharm el-Sheikh to Israel to have a meeting with Netanyahu, which again is a huge step towards normalization. It would probably mean that an announcement would be really forthcoming. They were strongly considering it, but before it was official, before it happened, it leaked to media, and then there was huge backlash at home and they canceled. My understanding also that the cancellation was in part because they wanted some kind of commitment from Israel to a future two-state solution. It's almost like the opposite of the Saudis, right? The Saudis, it's sort of like, they don't necessarily care what Israel says. They want Israel to do things. And the Indonesians want Israel to say two-state solution, which to me, I was like, well, just last week, Netanyahu signed a document that said that maybe if the Palestinians reform, et cetera, the end of the Gaza war could lead to a two-state solution. Like, why is that not enough for them? But it's not enough for them. Israel said no. So there were a couple of reasons, and so that's where we are now. But my understanding is that it's very, very close to happening. Maybe not close in time, right? We don't know if it's going to happen in a month or whatever, but they're sort of, you know, at the stage where they both sides really want it to happen, and they just need something to push it over the final hurdle.
It's interesting. One of the challenges and one of the reasons why there's such negative public opinion in Indonesia among some parts of the population, part of it is coming from an Islamic or an Islamist perspective, but the Indonesian constitution defines the country as an anti-colonial country. And Israel was always portrayed as this colonial entity that didn't have legitimacy to exist. And in a sense, that's changing. When President Subianto said the word shalom, or even when the Emir of Qatar and Turkey and Egypt, and obviously Israel-Turkey relations are not good right now, but are recognizing Israel's fundamental right to live in security along with the Palestinians, you have this recognition of the legitimacy of the state of Israel, along with support for the position of the Palestinians, which I believe in a sense diverges from the dominant narrative in much of the Palestinian Authority, which still sees Israel as an illegitimate entity that is, you know, destined or doomed to disappear from the map. But certainly much of the Arab world and the Muslim world, you have this acceptance of Israel's legitimacy and this desire to push Israel towards embracing a Palestinian state.
I would say Arab leadership. That's true.
But I think now's the time to develop action plans, not just for Saudi Arabia and for Indonesia, but for a broad range of Arab and Muslim countries. Many of them have very strong overlapping interests with the United States, would, you know, or with Israel, would benefit greatly from better relations with Israel and with the United States. And I think there is now an opportunity. President Trump has 3 more years in office. I think there really is an opportunity to move forward with the Abraham Accords. But obviously, Gaza is going to be a key part of that. And we've gotten through the first 72 hours after the deal. Hamas released the living hostages, but they haven't released, I think, so far, 7 of the dead hostages, of the bodies of the hostages that they're holding. And now there are conflicting reports how we've begun negotiations. President Trump declared we're now entering phase 2. But phase 2 is really, really difficult and complicated and amorphous. And it looks like that's where we're heading now.
Yeah, we talked to our guest Kobi Michal about this, but it's really unclear because, you know, first of all, the plan itself is not divided into phase 1, phase 2, right? You had the immediate thing, which happened, which is the hostages, the war stops, the hostages are released, Israel releases Palestinian terrorists from prison. And then you have things that are supposed to happen in the near future, right? And so among them is that you're supposed to have this like stability force and you're supposed to have a peace board and Palestinian technocrats and you're supposed to disarm Hamas, right? But it doesn't get into any details of that. I don't want to repeat things that you're going to hear our guests say in a couple minutes. But it's just like, because the plan didn't have details, there weren't mechanisms in place to implement those things that are supposed to be, quote unquote, phase 2, right? Phase 1 is only a few days. Those days have ended, and now we're like in this sort of limbo situation.
And just to quote, the very first clause in the 20-point plan is, Gaza will be a de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. And then you have point number 13, which talks about there will be a process of demilitarization of Gaza under the supervision of independent monitors, and they'll place the weapons permanently beyond use, and they'll decommission the weapons, and there'll be an internationally funded buyback and reintegration program, all verified by the independent monitors. And this is just one example. Who are these independent monitors? Who's right. going to be paying for them? How are we going to know that they're really reliable? Are they going to actually do the hard work?
But in the meantime, you have Hamas police officers on the streets of Gaza City, and you have Hamas killing, you know, members of families that oppose Hamas, and you have Qatari bulldozers coming in to help clear rubble. So, like, nature abhors a vacuum, and if this plan, you know, if the Trump administration and Israel and anyone else don't get moving on this plan, the Qataris are going to back Hamas reestablishing itself.
So I think you have two really important questions. One is, how are these negotiations on this very complex structure going to take place? Are they going to happen in Egypt? Who's going to be there? What's the format? And then the other very immediate question is, what happens next week when Israel gets intelligence that Hamas is using a Qatari bulldozer, not just to rebuild a hospital, to rebuild one of its tunnels, or Hamas is using cement or metal or electronics to rebuild that were brought in for hospitals or for bakeries that were brought, using them to rebuild their weapons. Now, Israel will want to act militarily to prevent that from happening. But already you have President Trump has declared that there's now peace. So, and the war is over. And that, I think, is going to be the critical question, how the U.S. and Israel work together and whether Israel is able to convince the U.S. that it needs to act, it needs to continue to act militarily in order to prevent Hamas from reconstituting the threat that it poses. This week's guest is Professor Kobi Michal. Professor Kobi Michal is a senior fellow at the Miskava Institute for National Security and a senior research fellow at the Institute for National Security Studies. He is also a visiting professor at the International Center for Policing and Security at the University of South Wales in the UK. He served before that as Deputy Director General of Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs and head of the Palestinian Arena, where I had the pleasure of working with him at the ministry. And Kobi is truly one of Israel's leading experts on the Palestinian arena and the Israeli-Palestinian relationship. He has published more than 20 books and monographs and more than 100 academic papers and chapters. Prior to his academic career, he served for 23 years in IDF intelligence, reaching the rank of colonel, and he was one of the founders and commanders of the Israeli-Palestinian security coordination apparatus that was set up following the Oslo Accords. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Professor Kobi Michael. Professor Kobi Michael, we're very happy that you're joining us today on Miscath Mideast Horizons. And it's been a dramatic week with so many developments, so many reports that are in some ways contradictory to each other. Could you start by, for our listeners, helping to make some order in all the reports? We had President Trump's 20-point plan, that we had an agreement that was signed by Israel and Hamas on October 9th. And then we had another declaration that was signed by the U.S., Qatar, Egypt, and Turkey 2 days ago. And we had the first 72 hours, and those are over. And Hamas did or didn't fulfill its obligations. And now we're in stage two, and there's different lines that Israel's supposed to retreat towards. Can you just sort of, let's say in Hebrew, lasot seder, to make some order for our listeners as to what's going on in terms of Israel, Gaza, Hamas, and the Trump peace plan?
Hello, Asher and Lav, and thank you for having me. Things are much more simple than they look because we have to understand that this plan is composed of three major stages or phases. The first one is the release of the hostages, live and dead, and then the redeployment of the IDF along the so-called yellow line. The second phase is the disarmament of Hamas, the demilitarization of the Gaza Strip, and further redeployment of the IDF. And the third stage is the establishment of the ISF, the International Stabilization Force, the Peace Board, and the technocrat governments, which is the alternative civilian governance of the Gaza Strip that should replace Hamas, and then the last redeployment or withdrawal of the IDF to the security perimeter. The plan is not, although it holds 20 articles, it is not very well detailed, okay? Actually, it is a framework. It is a general idea. And the sides, the parties, has to elaborate on these ideas, on this framework, and to negotiate in order to realize it, in order to implement that. We have to understand what was the point of departure of President Trump, who is behind the plan. And his idea was to seize immediately or as soon as possible the war in the Gaza Strip, because in his understanding, the war in the Gaza Strip was actually the ultimate barrier in front of his grand vision with regard to the region, with regard to the regional architecture, based on the normalization process between Israel and the Arab and Muslim countries, mainly the Saudi Arabia, but not only. And eventually, the regional architecture is not only, a sort of a nice, peaceful vision that President Trump has in his mind. It is something which is much more, I would say, accurate, connected to the ground, to the interests of the United States and his personal interests, which in this case are interlocated, okay? They are interrelated. He believes that by reshaping the entire regional architecture, actually he serves the major interests of the United States here in the region, and he can leverage these interests and these, I would say, outcomes in order to improve the American position in other arenas, mainly when it comes to Europe, to Ukraine, vis-a-vis the Russians, and the Chinese, okay?
Right. He instructed Witkoff that he has to get Ukraine done. That was his instructions that he gave from the Knesset to Witkoff while he was sitting on the balcony.
Yes. Eventually, Trump wants to reconstitute the American hegemony. He wants a sort of Pax Americana that begins in the Middle East and will be expanded to Europe and then to some other places. And he believes that under this American hegemony or Pax Americana, he will be able to promote the interests of the United States of America, mainly economic interests, because he's a businessman. And he doesn't, very interested in the details. He is very focused in the final outcome. He is very focused on the vision itself, not in the details. He leaves the details for the professionals, for the technocrats, for the envoys. And this is, by the way, one of the problems that we must be aware to, because if President Trump will lose its I would say focus, determination, decisiveness with regard to the further phases of his own plan, and I mean the idea of disarming Hamas, the demilitarization of the Gaza Strip, and so on and so forth, we might find ourselves in a sort of a stalemate or a problem. And this is, I would say, the main challenge of the State of Israel or the Israeli statesmanship, to keep President Trump focused, determined, decisive on his own plan until its full realization.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those details, because we're already seeing, I don't know, like cracks in the facade, I guess you could call it, right? Hamas is reestablishing itself in the areas that the IDF withdrew from. They're executing their opponents and you know, committing all kinds of acts of violence. And of course, they've broken the deal in the way that they're not returning all of the bodies of the hostages. They claim they can't find them. Israel thinks that they actually have access to more. What do you think are the immediate steps that are going to happen? Because we heard some mixed messages from President Trump on this.
Yes. First of all, I would like to correct Asher when he say that we have finished the first stage. No, we are in the first stage yet, okay? The first stage will be finished when we will get all of our hostages back. And unfortunately, we have only 7 of them.
Absolutely. I just imagine the 72 hours are completed. But you're right, they haven't done what they're supposed to do in 72 hours.
And I think that everybody that knows Hamas, even not very deeply, understands that there is no any surprise here. It was, very, very clear, at least to those who know Hamas, that this is the way that Hamas will behave. This is something which is in the DNA of this organization. And this organization does not intend to dismantle itself. And this organization does not intend to give up on his influence and position, not only in the Gaza Strip, but the entire Palestinian arena. And unfortunately, this organization will be backed by the Qatarians and by the Turks, because both countries are the biggest providers and supporters of Hamas. Both countries are Muslim Brotherhood, okay? And they support the Muslim Brotherhood, and Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood. And I think that they were clever enough in order to understand, and sovereign enough in order to understand, that what is important and crucial for President Trump is to release the hostages, the live hostages, and to declare about the end of the war and to continue. And when it comes to the other phases, then President Trump will be much more, I would say, tolerate, and they will be able to convince him that they need more time and Israel has to make some further concessions. And the idea that President Trump brought them to the front of the stage and empowered them, and they are very close to his ear, this is something that will enable them to leverage this position in order to keep the most crucial interests of Hamas. And I think that the Qatarians and the Turks are interested in keeping this interest. And the major interest is to keep Hamas as a relevant player in the Gaza Strip. First of all, as a platform or a leverage for increasing its influence in the entire Palestinian authority. because in the eyes of Hamas, as well as in the eyes of the Turks and the Qatarians, Hamas is a replacement for the PA, not a partner of the PA, but a replacement. They can be a partner for, you know, a very limited period of time, and as a sort of a tactic in order to topple down the Palestinian Authority. I think that we have to be well prepared to a reality where Hamas will not implement the plan or the agreement. Now the question is, and although President Trump said yesterday in a press conference, he said that they will disarm themselves, and if they will not do that, we will do that, and even violently. Okay, he said that in a very clear manner. But it doesn't mean necessarily that he means to back this saying.
I think also in the same press conference, I actually just pulled up the article, so we have the exact quote. You almost see, which to me sounds like the Qatari and Turkish influence on Trump, because he said that Hamas took out a couple gangs that were very bad. They killed a number of gang members. That didn't bother me much. It's okay. It's no different than other countries like Venezuela who send their gangs into the U.S. So it's like on the one hand, he's telling Hamas to disarm, and on the other hand, he's saying, you know, great job, Hamas, taking out the gangs that are just like the gangs from Venezuela and the U.S. And that just sounds to me like somebody must be putting these ideas in his head, right? Like somebody has to be telling him that these are foreign gangs, otherwise, because they're not.
Kobe, to that point, since you're somebody who follows what's happening in the Gaza Strip very closely in the Palestinian arena, what are we actually seeing in terms of these clashes between Hamas and the clans? Are the clans, these various families, are they really folding so quickly, or are they putting up a fight? Were you surprised by the fact that it appears that Hamas, at least in some of the cases, has been able to essentially defeat these other armed families very quickly? Can you just give us some clarity on what's actually happening?
The Gaza Strip, as well, by the way, as the entire Palestinian society, but mainly the Gaza Strip, is a very tribal society, okay? And what we see in the Gaza Strip for many months, from the south to the north, is the idea of clans, tribes, hamulas, that are, by the way, supported and backed by Israel in this way or another. They opposed Hamas before, and they just seized the opportunity in order to translate their opposition to Hamas to an actual control over territories, which are their natural territories. Okay, for an example, Hamulat Abu Shabab in the Rafah area, they are from this area. These are Bedouins from Tarabin tribe. By the way, this is the biggest Bedouin tribe, which is divided between Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the State of Israel, the Negev, and the Jordan. And they lived for centuries in this area, in Rafah area, okay? They felt after Israel occupied the Rafah and Hamas was not present there, they felt that this is a sort of historical opportunity in order to reconstitute their self-rule, or their self-control over this territory. And Israel saw it as an opportunity to improve the control over this territory by a sort of a proxy. When these Hamulas have succeeded in establishing their control over these territories, Hamas understood it as, I would say, a sort of a decline or a sort of a problem with regard to their control and to their sovereignty. And when they had the opportunity after the IDF withdrawal and they came back to these areas, the first thing that they did is to butcher, to murder these people, or at least to try to murder these people. They have succeeded, unfortunately, in some occasions. Just in the day before yesterday, they murdered 60 people in publicly in the streets. Because they understand that if they will not do that, they will lose their control. And this phenomenon will be expanded. I think that you have to be blind in order not to understand that when Hamas does that, it means that Hamas does not intend to dismantle itself. And if Hamas does that because they want to reestablish their control and their sovereignty and their civilian rule, it means that they intend to remain there. Now, we see some other Hamulas like El Majaide and El Astal in the central area, in Khan Yunis area and the Rubalah area, and Hamulat El Mani in the north, or other Hamulas. By the way, some of the heads of these Hamulas were or served in the security establishment during the Palestinian Authority control over the Gaza Strip. We know that Yasser Abu Shabab, for an example, was an officer in the preventive security apparatus. And we know that El Majaide and El Astal, they were officers in the same apparatuses. So this is also a reflection of a clash between Fatah and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, because these Hamulas are considered as Fatah supporters, okay?
Oh, so one of the things that your very unique experience is that you coordinated, you worked with the Palestinian security forces, I believe primarily in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank, though correct me if I'm wrong, but coordinating between the IDF and Palestinian security forces. Now the Trump plan envisions the International Stabilization Force, which is made up of international troops, but that is training also local Palestinian forces to restore order and provide internal security. What do you think are the chances, obviously, as you're pointing out, Hamas is rearming and reestablishing control in Gaza. What are the chances that some other Palestinian force could, in fact, you know, in a best case scenario, establish control over the Gaza Strip?
There is a chance, but it is dependent on many variables. I think that even according to Article 17, if I'm not wrong, 16 or 17 in the Trump plan, there is an option to begin the realization of stage three even before Hamas was disarmed, okay, and before achieving full demilitarization of the Gaza Strip. And the idea is to establish the ICF operation and the peace board and the technocrat government in the areas that Hamas is not present, mainly in the south. Okay, now I think that if Israel will contribute to that by agreeing to do that, even by expanding the southern part, I mean all the area between Khan Yunis and Rafah, I think that there is a higher probability for the success of security personnel of the Palestinian Authority that will be trained. They are already trained in Egypt, and we are talking about 5,000 or 6,000 of them. And if they will enter the region, which is empty of Hamas, with the presence of the technocrat, the government of technocrats, and the ISF, and everything will be full coordinated with the IDF, I think that this is something that can be done, and it should be done in parallel to the continuation of the war against Hamas in the northern part of the Gaza Strip, okay? I think that it will be even much easier and much more legitimized for Israel to do that, because Israel will indicate, or Israel will prove that it has no interest to occupy the Gaza Strip nor controlling the civilian population, and Israel cooperates with the plan of President Trump and wants to realize the plan. But we have an obstacle, which is Hamas. So let's divide between the south and the north of the Gaza Strip. Let's assure that the southern part will remain empty from the presence of Hamas. let's begin with the realization of the plan there. We'll build the capacities, we'll begin the reconstruction process there, and we'll continue the war in the north against Hamas until Hamas will be dismantled, until Hamas will be destroyed. Now, it is very crucial for another reason, because the strength of Hamas comes mostly from the civilian population and its control on this population. Now, if there will be a process of realization of the plan, implementation of the plan in the south, I'm almost sure that most of the Gazans, okay, will go to these areas, because they will find their prosperity and much better life than in the north under Hamas. And then Hamas will lose its strength, which is the population itself. And it will be much easier for the IDF to siege the areas that Hamas is present in order to dismantle Hamas. And Israel will be backed by the Americans and by the partners of President Trump, because they will see that Israel intends generally to implement the plan, but the implementation can be only gradual. It cannot be in one phase on the Gaza Strip in its entirely, because Hamas does not cooperate. Okay, so here is the moment of truth, I would say, of the Israeli statesmanship.
President Trump said that he would implement the disarmament of Hamas violently. And Prime Minister Netanyahu made a sort of a similar statement that I think he said all hell will break loose if Hamas doesn't disarm. So that seems like a different plan from first trying to, you know, implement the other parts of the plan in southern Gaza and then northern Gaza, unless you think that they're just speaking. So, I mean, what do you think will happen if they sort of follow? Do you think they're going to follow through on their threats, and how do you think that could play out?
I think that unfortunately, we will have no other option but to return to a violent cycle with Hamas, due to the reasons that I have mentioned before. The question is if Israel will do it alone and without any sort of legitimacy, and if Israel will do it under, circumstances of clash with President Trump and the American administration. I think that Israel should avoid from that. I think that Israel must keep President Trump in its side, must keep President Trump in its side. President Trump is the key. Without President Trump, his determination and his will to realize the plan, I think that Israel will face or will tackle very severe problems. And not only with the international community, but also with the regional players. Israel needs the cooperation of the regional players, and Israel needs the international legitimacy. And all of them are connected to the role of President Trump. And therefore, I think that the focus for the state of Israel should be and must be keeping President Trump in the frame, keeping President Trump commitment to the plan and committed to Israel. And therefore, Israel has to show, first of all, to President Trump that Israel intends and Israel has goodwill to realize his plan. And Israel has to convince President Trump that the only barrier in front of his plan is Hamas, that Israel is not a barrier in any case. Okay? And in order to convince him, I think that Israel will have to come or to initiate the idea of realizing Article 16, 17 in the southern part of the Gaza Strip. Otherwise, if Israel will insist that nothing will be implemented until Hamas will be dismantled and the Gaza Strip will be demilitarized, I think that at this point we might find ourselves in face of a very challenging problem.
Professor Michael, let's go for now to sort of shift to the Palestinian Authority in Judea and Samaria in the West Bank, where we have Abbas, Abu Mazen, who's in the 20th year of his 4-year term. We saw that the PA, in a sense, had a very difficult time retaking control of territory that it lost in the Jenin refugee camp in December of last year and January of this year. And so basically Israel had to roll in and retake those areas. We see, according to the latest polling by Shikaki, that Hamas is the most popular political party in the West Bank. How do you see dynamics? And I think it's fair to expect Hamas's popularity to rise now that it's won the release of all of these incarcerated terrorists. What do you see as likely to happen in the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank over the next 3 months, 6 months, over the next year?
I'm not so optimistic in this regard. The Palestinian Authority, even according to Plan Trump, should go through a very substantial reform process in order to be a revitalized, although he didn't use this term, which was coined by President Biden, okay? But it should be a revitalized Palestinian Authority, and they have a long journey to go through until they will reach to this status. And by the way, even in the plan itself, there is no any reference to the establishment of a Palestinian state. There is only a path or a door that will be opened, okay, towards such a horizon. But I think that President Trump is in the Israeli side in this regard, and even some of the original player, mainly when it comes to the Saudis and to the Emirates. And you know something, I think that even when it comes to the Egyptians, I think that all of them believe that the Palestinian Authority is not capable not only to return to control effectively the Gaza Strip, but it is not capable even to control effectively the territories which are under its direct control, and I mean areas A and B in the Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank.
So do you think on the day after Abbas, we have one centralized Palestinian Authority? Do you think we have a breakdown to different centers of power? And also, what do you think is in Israel's interest? Does Israel want to preserve one central authority in Ramallah? Does it want to work with different emirates or different power brokers in different areas?
First of all, I do not believe that under the presidency of President Abbas, something will change in a very dramatic manner in the Palestinian Authority. I do not believe that he really intends to do some significant and substantial reforms. I'm not sure that even he declared already about elections that will take place a year after the end of the war in the Gaza Strip. I'm not sure at all that these elections will really take place, because he's pretty aware to his situation and the absence of any legitimization among his own constituency in the Palestinian Authority. And therefore, I don't have any hopes when it comes to Abu Mazen. The problem is that I don't have any hopes with regard to those that will come after Abu Mazen, if they will come from the same milieu, from the same group, okay? If it will be Hussein Sheikh or Majid Abu Faraj or people which are from the old guard, okay, of the PLO, the old guard of Fatah. Because all of these people were very badly educated and indoctrinated, and they are not really interested in establishing an independent, functioning and responsible Palestinian state that will live peacefully side by side to the state of Israel. No, they are mostly interested in destroying the Zionist project, okay? And they are playing the game that unfortunately is played by the international community when it comes to the slogan of two-state solution. And they use this slogan, and they use some useful idiots in the international arena that believe in this slogan without understanding the essence of this slogan. Because, as you probably know, Asher, since our days in the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, that when the Palestinian says two-state solution, they refuse to add only one word, okay? Which is nation, to nation-state solution, because they don't believe that there is a right of self-determination for the Jewish people, which is translated to an independent state, no matter in which borders, okay, which is the nation-state of the Jewish people, because they don't believe that there is such a thing of a Jewish people. So I don't have too many hopes when it comes to the old guard of the Fatah. Now, I think that in order to create a very substantial change in the Palestinian psyche, in the Palestinian ethos, and I'm talking about the Palestinian collective as a whole, not about individuals, okay? We have to focus on the collective. In order to create a very significant change, we need, first of all, a very different leadership. The leadership that I see in front of my eyes today, I'm not sure at all that this is the leadership that can make such a shift, such a change in the Palestinian psyche, in the Palestinian ethos. And therefore, I think that we have to be very sober with regard to our expectations. Now, what is the Israeli interest? The Israeli interest is that the Palestinian Authority will continue functioning, even in a very low level of functioning, because otherwise, if there is no Palestinian Authority, if there is no any Palestinian entity that takes control over the daily life of the Palestinians, and we are talking about a population of almost 3 million, then the responsibility will be upon the Israeli shoulders, okay? And I don't think that we want it. I don't think that we want to be in the centers of the most populated areas in the West Bank. And I think that it is our interest that the Palestinian Authority will do that. And they have to remind us that with all the difficulties, there is security cooperation with the security apparatuses of the Palestinian Authority, because we have common interest, or we have common threat, which is Hamas, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. And I think that the Palestinian Authority knows pretty well that without the IDF and the General Security Services presence in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank, including in the territories under the control of the Palestinian Authority, I mean areas A and B, they understand pretty well that without that, they would have been diminished, okay? They would have found themselves in a situation which is very similar to the situation of June 2007 in the Gaza Strip. And therefore, they have an interest to continue cooperating with us when it comes to security affairs. I think that it is our interest that they will continue functioning there. What is going to be there for the long run? I'm not sure. It depends on developments that will take place in the new regional architecture. I think that if there will be a new regional architecture, if we will be able to expand the Abraham Accords, and the Palestinian issue as a whole will be dealt under the umbrella of this regional architecture, I think that we will find ourselves in front of many new opportunities, spaces that do not exist today. And I think that by enlarging the pie, by adding new players, new agendas, new interests, and mainly new resources, Israel and the Palestinians will be able to make some further concessions, and they might be more flexible, because they will be able to be compensated by this regional architecture. And I'm not sure that eventually the Palestinian dream of independence will be realized necessarily in the way that the Palestinians themselves anticipate. Okay? Maybe it will be in a different form. I don't know, and I wrote about it several times, maybe a very loose federation composed of two provinces, okay, the province of Gaza and the province of the West Bank, without geographical connection between of them, because at least not geographical connection to the sovereign state of Israel. Later on, this loose federation will be part of a Jordanian-Palestinian Confederation, okay? I mean, I think that there are many options, and some of the options are options that we can even cannot imagine under the current circumstances, okay? They will come out they will be shown, and they will be discovered when the new regional architecture will take place. I think that for the time being, Going back to your question, it will be preferable for the state of Israel that the Palestinian Authority will continue existing. And we have to remain sober enough in order to understand that water from this rock will not come out. When it comes to the final status agreement or something like that, okay?
Professor Kobi Michael, thank you so much for being with us. This has been very interesting, and we could have gone on much longer, but you're a very busy person, so we'll let you go, and we'd love to have you on again.
And I want to recommend everybody, Professor Kobi Michael led a very important project at the Miskav Institute, the Israel 2.0 project. You can find it on our website, www.miskavins.org, which provides a new vision for Israel on the day after. It was led by Professor Kobi Michael and Professor Gabi Siboni, and I highly recommend that everybody check it out.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in. Please make sure to like and subscribe to this podcast and follow the Miskav Institute across all social media platforms and at www.miskavins.org. That's miskavins.org. Send your comments, your questions, topics you'd like us to discuss to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, and we'll see you next time.